we think of the main actors shaping EU law, we usually think of the Court of Justice or national courts, perhaps the political institutions of the European Union, or even some of the more powerful member states. But there is a discrete category of actors whose influence warrants more attention.
Le traité est muet à cet égard. La Commission, suivant en cela son service juridique, a été d'avis qu'il lui appartenait de se faire sa propre opinion et de ne pas laisser cette opinion uniquement à l'État membre concerné. Elle a donc utilisé l'article 35 et l'article 36 pour précisément se faire son opinion sur l'applicabilité de l'article 34.
The legal services of EU institutions and the legal advisors that compose these structures play an often crucial role in the development of EU law. Their authoritative presence in translating politics into law and mediating conflicting interests is one of the most interesting and often overlooked features of EU legal dynamics. Welcome to the second episode of Integration Through Pod. I'm Miguel Montedelgado. I'm a doctoral researcher at the Law Department of the European University Institute in Florence and one of the coordinators of the EU Law Working Group here at the UI. For this episode, we are delighted to host Päivi Leino-Sandberg, professor of transnational European law at the University of Helsinki. Päivi joined me to discuss her most recent monograph titled The Politics of Legal Expertise in EU Policy Making. This book draws on interviews with over 60 EU lawyers and policymakers and brings light to the role that this invisible community of EU legal advisors has in the making of EU law.
La Cour va d'abord rendre un arrêt dans l'affaire C-345 de 95, République française contre Parlement européen, la Cour déclare et arrête, premièrement.
I started by asking Päivi to tell us a little bit about the book.
A little bit about the book. Well, it's a book that I've been actually working on for quite many years. The background actually comes from having been a legal advisor myself. So I spent about 10 years working for the Finnish government for various different ministries, foreign affairs, finance, prime minister's office, justice. And of course, through that way, got rather good insight of what happens in the EU institutions, especially since I was involved in running two of the council presidencies in 1999 and 2006. So that, of course, taught me a lot about how law works in real life. I mean, coming from the university with a fresh PhD in European law. And I think that the book is basically the story of what I saw when I was working as a legal advisor. It's in a way, it's an inside job written from within the institutions. And of course, the background is that it builds a lot on my own experiences, but also being a lawyer, of course, sources are very important. And when you come back, you think, well, I could not possibly write just a book about what I saw. So in addition to my own experiences, it also builds on a lot of interviews and stories shared by other legal advisors working within the institutions and also people that work with lawyers. So they explain how they see us lawyers working in the institutions and the impact of law. And I think that in a way is then the broader story. I mean, it brings together individual stories by lawyers, but also puts them in a broader perspective of what law does in European integration and also maybe tests a little bit our assumptions of what law is and what kind of effects it has.
Okay, that's great. Of course, the book, for the listeners who haven't had the chance to read it, it's a work in this empirical legal approach to approach legal research, more qualitative than quantitative, essentially based on interviews. Mm-hmm. You did more than 60 different interviews over a period of around 5 years, was more or less
something
this.
Like that. Okay. Yeah.
Well, one of the central themes of the book that you address concerns the significance of legal advisors in managing the boundaries between law and politics mm-hmm. in the EU. So you focus fundamentally on legal advisors working for three EU institutions, the Council and the Commission and the Parliament. And then in the epilogue to the book, you present a very persuasive example of this management of boundaries between law and politics, and use as a case study the establishment of Next Generation EU. And Next Generation EU, you describe this very well, is this creature of a very complex legal engineering that challenged a rather established doctrinal reading of Article 311 regarding the unions, TFEU, regarding the union's own resources. Now, doing so, in the book you raise the attention to the thinness of ex-ante control of constitutionality in EU law, the dynamics of what can be described as fait accompli, essentially, and how legal service, and in particular the Council's legal service, ends up playing a fundamental role, arguably more significant than the Court of Justice, in ensuring that in the interpretation and application of the treaties, the law is observed. Could you explain a bit this this argument that you set forth?
More in general terms on or in relation to the RF, because of course most of the book was already written when COVID hit the EU. So all this sort of empirical work was done. And of course, well, the Council chapter probably is the chapter that has sort of relies most on my own experiences from having worked in the Council. And of course, I mean, that's the general grievance of all lawyers working for the member state governments, and that they sit in a Council working group, and there's a legal issue that rises. And of course, then there's a lot of sort of excitement in the air about, you know, what will the Council Legal Service say? You know, if you have a political problem and you would want to solve it, and you know, I mean, everyone among the lawyers around the table know that there is flexibility in the law and there are different interpretations. Some of these interpretations will certainly be more beneficial to what you're trying to argue, while other interpretations will kill what you're trying to achieve just in a second, you know. So when the Council legal opinion then actually arrives, you know, people will be holding their breaths, basically, and thinking, mm-hmm. you know, this will be decisive for whatever, you know, my government will try to achieve. So if you actually end up in a situation where the legal services position backs up what you've been trying to argue all along, you know, there is celebration. But at the same time, it can kill any political agenda in just a matter of seconds. And of course, you know, there are a lot of books written about law in European integration by historians, for example, or legal sociologists, who in a way approach the law a little bit from the outside. But being a lawyer myself and sort of coming from this inner circle of people being involved in the legal discussions, you of course see this flexibility in law, and you see that fairly often, you know, there are different lines of argumentation that you can build up. And of course, that's what we do as lawyers. I mean, we serve a client, we have an agenda that we are there to back up. We are there to provide arguments that serve whichever client we're trying to assist. And you see the flexibility, and you see that these readings, basically, they will create both winners and losers. And the question becomes, you know, who gets to decide? What is the process in which the choices between these different readings are being made? And of course, I mean, I'm not the first one arguing. There are many others who've argued before that EU debates often sort of take the form of no alternative, you know? That fairly often, whatever is being proposed is proposed as this is what has to be done. There really is no alternative. And of course, this is pretty much what also happened after the COVID crisis emerged. I would argue that there would have been quite a few other options and legal constructions possible for delivering a lot of aid to those affected. Solutions that would have been much easier to reconcile with existing readings of the treaties. However, there was a reason to put forward this particular agenda. I see the reason as tied pretty much to pre-existing institutional plans, which we all know had been there for already quite some time. And when this crisis emerged, there was a chance, in a way, to jump forward in integration. That was one model. It has strengths, but it also has weaknesses. And in a way, what worries me most is that in this type of a setting, there is very little discussion. There is very little sort of debate between winners and losers and different types of alternatives, which may have existed, however, were never really brought to the table. So we ended up with this so-called only possible solution, which, of course, we all agree is in great tension with how treaties had been read before.
Right. And when you talk about the concerning between this lack of dialogue between winners and losers, do you mean this lack of dialogue as in dialogues within the institution? So this was something that was mostly being discussed in the council. Do you think that other institutions should be brought in more for this discussion? Or do you mean a broader discussion even involving national parliaments?
Well, I think in general, I mean, in a way, well, what drives all of my research is the sort of general concern for missing democratic governance in the EU. So that is sort of my constant worry. That's what I'm always talking about. How power is exercised in the EU and whether it's transparent enough. So basically that is a theme that runs through everything that I do. Right. But of course, this particular context was very specific. I mean, what the outcome is basically the biggest constitutional change in the EU that has happened for at least a decade. And it just took place basically nearly overnight in a European Council meeting. The Parliament certainly was not very closely involved in the discussions. And I would also say many national parliaments had nearly nothing to do with the debates.
Exactly. And then this element that you bring the attention of the reader, which is something that maybe we don't consider this often, is that because what you learn in law school is that, okay, you know, the council will enact whatever piece of secondary legislation or amendment that it decides to, but the union is a union founded on the rule of law, and we will have subsequent judicial review by the court if need be within the means of avenues of procedure that exist in the system of procedural law. Mm-hmm. But then as you explain, this is actually more of a fiction than what we could actually expect, in the sense that even if the court was invited today, as it could possibly be, either in the context of a preliminary reference or maybe a direct action, to adjudicate on the validity of this constitutional mutation, with all likelihood, as the consequences would be so dramatic to what is unfolding already at the EU level, the court would never adjudicate against. And we see how the power of reality waits over the court in some of its cases, Pringle being a good example of this. And in this sense, the only filtering mechanism to ensure the respect for the law actually comes from these actors that we don't think about this often, that are the central characters of this book, which are the legal advisors. Mm-hmm. Right. And then you do this interesting comparison between even the, as you said, the anticipation regarding what the Council Legal Service will say, as almost a Conseil d'État exercising this ex ante constitutional review, but they don't feel comfortable with this role because they know there is almost a conflict of interests, in the sense that, as you said, they're legal advisors advising a client that has a specific institutional agenda. They're not independent arbiters in this role. But at the same time, you do also say that this is not the bread and butter of the council legal service or any legal service. These are exceptional moments. Do you think that in the day-to-day of the council legal service, we could count on this legal service or other legal services to actually exercise that function a bit more easily?
Well, I would say, I mean, I know many of the legal advisors working working in the institutions. Many of them I actually consider my friends. And I really do have quite a lot of faith in both their skills and in their integrity and also their commitment. So, I mean, what they're doing is they're generally trying to promote what would be good for all of us. But then, of course, there is the question of how this good, common good, is defined. And that maybe is what worries me a little bit, is that fairly often, I mean, this is also something I've tried to sort of map with interviews and trying to ask them, you know, what is it that you're trying to promote? And of course, you will see that their conception of the good is relatively narrow, and it usually does coincide with questions such as more powers for the EU, more legislation on this, more legislation on that. Sort of, let's set up a new agency for that function. I, on the other hand, would think that there are also other issues that are quite important, such as how you take your decisions, you know, keeping citizens on board. And of course, one really fundamental issue is also the role of constitutional courts and the relationship between the European Court of Justice and constitutional courts. Because in a way, I mean, as you say, I mean, there really is, I mean, do I dare to say it? I'm not sure if there is a constitutional court in the EU as we stand, because everyone knows that there are extremely few cases where the Court of Justice would have intervened in any way. In particular, the European Council seems to be rather fundamentally beyond any control. So it seems that there is a sort of thinking that if there is political agreement among the leaders, then the court should not intervene. And this, of course, does also hamper the credibility of the Court of Justice in the eyes of constitutional courts and also constitutional bodies. We don't have a constitutional court, but another type of a committee, because they know, just like the legal advisors in the institutions know, that the Court of Justice will not intervene. And also, maybe for that reason, I don't see the discussion provoked by many of these constitutional bodies as something automatically negative, because I think it is good that there are reminders about some limits, because in a way, I would think that by protecting these limits, the EU would also protect its own legitimacy in the eyes of sort of constitutional players.
Right. You said it now, and even you raised the attention in the book for something that I was completely unaware of, that in the there are not a lot of rules regulating these legal services, but there are some that provide for this kind of obligation of the members of the legal service to advance union interest or to promote union interest, which makes sense. It would be, and then of course union interest would be translated into the specific institutional agenda of the institution they represent. But then you also said that this means sometimes expanding the reach of union law, maybe these legal advisors contributing to this problem of competence creep and the extension of competences where the direct competence of the union is perhaps limited. So this seems to be a bit the way that legal advisors understand EU law, which is, I'd say, even consistent with the case law of the court in that regard. At the same time, you claim that these legal advisors are not dogmatic in the sense that they see the treaties, this union law, as this living organism that can evolve. Well, I would ask then, what are the red lines for the legal advisors when it comes to the integrity of union law? Is there any opening in the evolution of the legal positioning of institutions regarding, for instance, how much uniform of application of union law you'll have and how much space you should give to national identity of member states? Because ultimately, that's one of the elements where these issues are normally raised. Do you see any opening in the, when you talk to legal advisors, do you see there in their thinking any willingness to move EU law more towards this direction, or still to be committed to primacy uniform application as established in the case law of the court?
That was a long question, or actually many questions. I could take this in various different directions, but actually to me, the COVID package really was a game changer, that until then I thought that there were issues that were so fundamental that, for example, they would require a treaty change. I no longer think that. I think that treaty changes are extremely unlikely, not only because they're difficult to construct, but also because they're unnecessary. You can always find another interpretation. You can find some kind of general principle in the treaties, which you can then read so expansively that you conveniently get to bypass some of the sort of difficult clauses putting constraint on the EU and what it can do. So in that sense, my thinking has changed in the past 2 years. I don't think that legal advisors are sort of a uniform package, you know. You know one, you know them all. I mean, they're of course all different. We're all different, and we come with our own packages of, which of course is also very much influenced by where we come from, you know. What kind of, I mean, I'm certainly very aware that whatever I say and whatever I think and whatever I write is framed by my background, which is that I am a Finn and I have worked for a government. Law has a very specific meaning in Finnish society. I mean, historically, it's always had the role of protecting us against trespasses by great powers. In that sense, I think also it actually reaches very deep into how we understand the function of law and constitutions and the role of different procedures, but of course also how we position ourselves in relation to the EU. So in that sense, there's not just one advisor. I mean, they have a job to do, and that job is to promote the interests of the institution that they serve. So in that sense, I mean, I think being sort of lawyers with integrity, that's the job that they do. And of course, the assignment that they're given is not usually to sort of find reservations or constraints, but find the legal basis that enables the realization of the institutional agenda. Right. So it would be unfair, actually, to expect them to do the job. But then there is a bigger question, which is that how do we understand what they do? I mean, they're not independent servants of the law in that sense. They're servants of institutions. And maybe that then means that we have a slightly wrong understanding of what, in fact, it is that they're doing when, for example, the Council Legal Service adopts an opinion. It's not an independent reading of the law. It's a reading that is meant to serve whatever they see as the interest of the institution that they serve. And that is then my broader worry, that I see too little democratic discussion. I also think the confidentiality surrounding these legal opinions is a huge problem, that there should be more debate about what they advise. You know, is it solid advice? Are there alternative readings, which should be debated and are extremely difficult to debate if we don't know what that advice is? Because obviously I've also been in situations where the legal opinion does not get the support of the legal advisors sitting around the table. I mean, they would say, what is this, you know? What are they advising? Where did this interpretation come from? Or just as often it happens that the Commission and the Council Legal Services completely disagree on the reading of the law and what the treaties will allow. So that also demonstrates that there are very often different readings, and these readings get a lot of political consequences, which we should know and be able to debate.
Right, and just as a curiosity, because the Council Legal Services is an actor that we don't think of as often, maybe because the attention goes more to the Commission's Legal Service, and we know that the Commission's Legal Service answers directly to the President of the Commission. But when it comes to the Council Legal Service, what are the dynamics? I would imagine there is a special relationship between the presidency, the rotating presidency of the council, and the Council Legal Service. But at the same time, it is this permanent structure of bureaucrats that goes beyond the 6-month period of a presidency. So how does that work?
Well, that's one. I actually discussed this in one of the chapters based on interviews, but this is also something that I've experienced myself. That obviously, I mean, the formal answer would be the Council Legal Service is there to assist the presidency. But of course, presidencies also come in various different forms. There are those that are tremendously strong. There are presidencies that are tremendously weak. There are matters where the presidency may not have a very firm opinion, or issues that they're not too eager to promote. And depending on the sort of all of these qualities, the legal service may have more or less leeway. But they also see their own role as rather strong. I mean, all of us that have needed to run the presidency have had intense discussions with the legal service about what the presidency is allowed to promote, what they're allowed to propose to the member states, who gets to draft what, you know, that type of issues. So their influence within the council is tremendous, and I would say stronger than that of the presidency.
On that note, Heidi, thank you very much for joining us for the second episode of Integration Through Pod.
Thank you for listening. This episode was recorded at Villa Salviati in Florence, home of the UI's Law Department and also of the Historical Archives of the European Union. The episodes are recorded at the UI's Radio Cavallo studio, the UI's researchers' community's very own radio station. We'll share a link in the description so that you can go and check some of Radio Cavallo's programming.